Hi, good morning. My name is Jennifer. I'm a third-year medical resident from Mount Sinai Beth Israel in New York City. The title of our case, as Dr. Stoner said, is an unexpected bleed, a case of syphilitic aortitis. So just to start off, the current guidelines from the United States Preventive Services Task Force indicates that there's really no indication for routine screening of syphilis in an asymptomatic, low-risk individual. However, recent trends as of the early 2000s suggest an increasing incidence of syphilitic infections, primarily primary and secondary syphilis, since the early 2000s. And so we present a case of syphilitic aortitis in an otherwise asymptomatic man to evaluate whether there really is an indication or perhaps a lower threshold to screen. So to start, this is a 58-year-old gentleman with a history of tobacco abuse, about 20 pack years, and poor medical compliance. His last follow-up with a primary care doctor was more than 2 to 3 decades ago. He initially presented to an outside hospital with a syncopal episode due to large volume hematoemesis. Vital signs upon arrival, he was tachycardic to 125, profoundly hypotensive, 47 over 30, with an O2 saturation of 93% on room air. Because he was so obtunded and minimally responsive to noxious stimuli, the decision was made to intubate him for airway protection, and he was subsequently placed on pressor support as he was not responding to fluid resuscitation. At the outside hospital, by hospital day number 3, he underwent an EJD that showed 2 lesions in the stomach. It was unclear where the lesions were, but there was no active stigmata of bleeding. As a result, they applied epinephrine to the site and also applied clips. However, his hematoemesis persisted. In the 24 hours after his EJD, he put out about 2 liters of bright red blood through his oral gastric tube. And it was at that point, on hospital day number 3, that they decided to do a CT abdomen and pelvis, and they found an 8-centimeter thoracic aortic aneurysm with both a fusiform and saccular component. I have the CT abdomen. We'll load it and look at it later. But there was also presence of intra-abdominal free air. And because of these findings, he was transferred to a tertiary care center for intervention. Just to preview, his hemoglobin upon arrival at this outside hospital was 11.8, suggesting that perhaps he did have an acute onset anemia. And at the time of transfer, it was 6.9. Keep in mind, during this brief stay at the outside hospital, he received a total of 8 liters of IV fluid, 5 units of packed red blood cell, and 3 units of FFP with no reversal of his anemia. So upon transfer to the tertiary care center, he underwent a left thoracotomy, a thoracic aortic aneurysm repair, and repair of gastric perforation. Histology report from the descending aortic aneurysm actually showed granulomatous aortitis with necrotizing granuloma. And so when we look at the imaging, if you take a look at the CT abdomen, you can see the presence of intra-abdominal free air. If you take a look at the 3D CT, you can see here the saccular, berry-like component of the descending aorta, and also the fusiform. If you take a look at the histology report, there you see a center of necrosis surrounded by a periphery of plasma cell. That is located to your right. And so at this tertiary care center, we decided to do labs on him given the CT abdomen and pelvis finding, and he was found to have a RPR titer of 1 to 16. The confirmatory troponemal testing of fluorescent troponemal antibody was positive. All other testing was negative, including HIV, gonorrhea, and chlamydia obtained from his urine specimen, as well as his acute hepatitis panel. If there was a concern for fungal aortitis, the galactomannan antigen also came back negative. And so in short, his hospital course, he was started on intravenous penicillin G for empiric treatment of neurosyphilis, not just tertiary. And there was a discussion that prior to discharge, he may be considered for benzathine penicillin, which is the treatment for tertiary syphilis. But ultimately, he was stabilized, and he was able to be extubated, tapered off of pressor support. And when he finally regained consciousness, if you will, he was fairly alert and oriented, no focal neurological impact from his injuries. And upon deeper review of system, he did admit to prior contacts with sex workers in his 20s. So long story short, he came from Croatia as a teenager, stayed largely in New York City during his 20s, endorsed contacts with sex workers. He was heterosexual throughout his 20s. And he said that at some point in his 30s, he had a urinary tract infection. No rash, but he went to a primary care doctor who then gave him an intramuscular injection. And that was that. Since his 30s, he has not been to a general practitioner, and that has been about 3 decades since his presentation to the hospital. Prior to the onset of his hematoemesis, he had no prior history of rash, ulcers, or intravenous drug use. And, of course, he denied any prior STD screening, given his poor follow-up with a primary care provider. And so, in short, this near-catastrophic case of tertiary syphilis really highlights the importance of STD screening and perhaps may need us to reevaluate the role of syphilis screening given its latent side effects. And perhaps this case does highlight the need for a thorough and lower threshold of screening in an individual that might not be as forthcoming as this gentleman was, and perhaps in an individual with poor medical follow-up. And to close it off, I just have a question for the panel. Given that this individual had tertiary syphilis and he was treated for neurosyphilis, he never got an lumbar puncture during his hospital course. Would you have obtained a lumbar puncture for this individual before going forth with treatment of neurosyphilis? And then with him, his RPR titer was 1 to 16. Do you typically anticipate a relatively lower titer for someone with untreated latent tertiary syphilis? And that is it.
Okay, at this point, I'd like to invite the panelists to come up. We have Dr. Karen Scott from University of California at San Francisco and California Department of Public Health, Dr. Hillary Reno from Washington University in St. Louis, and Dr. Ned Hook from University of Alabama at Birmingham. I would like to start off by asking a question to the panel. Let's start with you, Dr. Scott. So this gentleman comes into your emergency room, and he is vomiting blood. Is the first thing you're going to do to order a syphilis test? Or maybe the second thing? Would that even be on your differential diagnosis at this point?
No, I mean, honestly, no. That initial presentation. But
so what do you make of this case then?
Well, given that I am the OB-GYN that's on the panel, I mean, the ID people, let me put that out there. But based on what I just have learned, that the thoracic aortic aneurysm, as well as like on day 3, I think, with a CT scan, with the superposition of the sacular fusiform aneurysm, I think is virtual diagnostic of syphilitic aortitis. But that would be my suspicion then. But that's just having recently really learned about vascular and cardiovascular syphilis. So that would be the first thing that I would have thought of. But that's day 3. The initial presentation, I would not have thought to have ruled out for syphilis.
So, Dr. Reno?
Sir.
What do you think? Would you have gotten an RPR at some point? This guy continues to require pressors and blood and fluids.
I'm pretty sure the answer is no. So, when I lecture residents on cardiovascular syphilis, when I lecture residents on syphilis, I mention cardiovascular syphilis mainly not because it's such a common presentation, but mainly because I'm trying to hook everybody going into cardiology as a discipline. And so to tell them that, you know, infections do have effects on their favorite organs and that they shouldn't ignore what we're trying to teach them. But I think one of the roles in ID is that we really have to have that very broad differential and question everything, every step of the way. And so I think it's maybe the RPR certainly wouldn't have been ordered as he's in the ICU, but at some point you have to look at the whole picture. You have to look at the imaging, the pathology. I still find it humorous when we go to radiology to look at the images or pathology because they're kind of surprised to see us there. But ID, that's what we do. And so I would want a very detailed description of the imaging. And this is the descending aorta, correct? Which I think is a little less common in classic cardiovascular syphilis. It tends to be ascending about 60% and arch 30%, so the remainder would be in the other parts of the aorta. But and then pathology, reviewing with a pathologist. You know, is this necrotizing granuloma? that they saw, was this more of a like a gummatous presentation? Did it look more like an abscess, or was it a true necrotizing granuloma? Because you always have to keep a broad differential no matter what your tests show you, and to ensure that you're not dealing with something else as well. So,
Dr. Hook?
Before I sort of comment, I'd like to ask Dr. Gao a question. Did the patient have a chest x-ray? Was it normal?
No, it was not normal.
Just checking. I mean, I think the indication for thinking about syphilis in this man would have been his chest x-ray for me, not his presentation. The other question I have, which is just, you know, it's interesting to reflect upon. When I presume that he did not have his RPR done immediately, and if he didn't have his RPR done immediately, he had already received an exchange transfusion, right? His total blood volume had been replaced by transfusion if it was more than 2 days after it was gone. And I don't know how to put that into place, but it's sort of interesting to reflect upon whether or not you can do it. You know, we should find somebody who's got syphilis or a positive RPR, and after they have plasmapheresis, see if it's still positive. So, just a couple reflective thoughts on this. But I would also sort of comment, more than a few years ago, when I was on the faculty at Johns Hopkins, I was on the Thayer firm attending, and as a project for our team, we did admitting RPRs on every patient for a number of months admitted to the service. Baltimore is a place where syphilis is relatively endemic. Less than 5% of patients had positive RPRs. Some of them had a history of treatment, some of them didn't. We did lumbar punctures on over half of the patients. We found no cases of neurosyphilis. And we treated several people, or at least initiated treatment on several people, with long courses of benzathine penicillin. But our conclusion was that whenever it was that routine screening for syphilis went out of fashion, that it was probably a reasonable decision. I also think it's important in this thing, and I loved your case, and I thank you so much for presenting it, but I also think we live in a world where if I had to sort of prioritize what routine test I would do on everybody I was admitting, I'd probably put HIV and hepatitis C way above RPRs, even today. That said, he's a fascinating case that has a number of other questions, some of which you've already raised. Sorry for rambling on, Brett.
Oh, that's good. So panel, how secure is this diagnosis in the sense that he has a positive RPR and a confirmatory treponemal test, he has a clinical presentation that seems consistent with cardiovascular syphilis, but Dr. Reno, you mentioned this is the descending aorta, and does that make you concerned?
Not particularly. Again, I really would want to review with a pathologist in more detail. As we are seeing rates of syphilis increase, we're going to see unusual presentations of it. And so keeping an open mind and including syphilis on the differential in a situation like this is important. I think to get to like one of your questions about like how does the RPR titer help us, and I think it doesn't really. Ultimately, I would expect the RPR titer to be low later on, but I can't really comment specifically on 1:16. I think you still have to have a broad differential, and he did have a CT angio, so did just making sure radiologists didn't think there was an arteritis as possible on the differential would be important for him. But that would be kind of one of the things I would add into the differential.
Dr. Hook, what's your take on this? And then what about the LP question?
Well, I like Hillary, think syphilis is the great imitator. It causes a broad spectrum of disease. I think you have to respect the answer. Relatively high RPR. Conventional wisdom suggests that he may have had his infection more recently than just 30 years ago, and I would sort of remind the audience that sex doesn't necessarily stop it when people hit their 40s or 50s or whatever. So the question becomes whether or not this is true, unrelated or not. He had an atypical location. He had an unusual presentation. He was lucky that they didn't biopsy his aorta, which actually has been done in settings like this in people with aneurysms who were bleeding. But I think this is an instance where you have to respect the case of the positive RPR and treat him accordingly. You had no history to guide you, and so you're going to have to treat him for syphilis of unknown duration with aortitis. High dose penicillin is indicated. Many people, I guess, would add long term benzathine penicillin. I would in this patient. I think the issue of the ALP has to do with the patient and what's going to go on. And I think the question becomes, so let's remember one of the things that I sort of preach ad nauseum on rounds at our place is when you order a test, think about what you're going to do with the results. And so that's really the issue. And the first question is doing an RPR going to change your therapy for this man? The answer is no. But the second question, I'm sorry, thank you. It's still a little early and I haven't quite finished my cup of coffee. But would the LP change your management of this man? And I think the answer is categorically no. On the other hand, what it would do would be to provide you with one other important piece of data, which would be important and useful in follow-up of him going forward. There's another question that comes up in the management of syphilis patients, which actually there are some data on, which is in patients who have positive RPRs, relatively high titer positive RPRs as this man, does having an LP to follow going forward help you with your analysis of data? And Dr. Christina Mara from the University of Washington has published that, and her conclusion was that the peripheral RPR often parallels changes in the CSF. I'm not sure. I still like the LPs. I love to have the data. I like to find out what's going on. I think sometimes they raise more questions than answers.
What's the clinical indication for an LP in this case? In other words, he's not having neurological symptoms.
It's Dr. Workowski's fault. It's in the guidelines. I think the concern is that patients with longstanding with cardiovascular syphilis may well also have central nervous system involvement, because I think most people in older data would suggest that benzathine penicillin alone is probably adequate for treating syphilitic aortitis, but the question of neurosyphilis is less clear.
So, Dr. Scott, I want to ask you, in California, you're seeing high rates of syphilis, but primarily in men who have sex with men. What's your experience with cardiovascular syphilis in the OBGYN setting?
I have not seen it.
You've not seen it, but you're certainly on the lookout for it.
I mean, yes, like I said, I just haven't come across this and learning more, but I think what the other kind of experts are saying is just being in the differential and being cognizant of that cardiovascular aortitis can happen in the setting of those who have not been, you know, treated for early syphilis. So I would not have thought, again, to have done this, but having read about it and looking again, like the only time I would have recognized it, that it could have been was day three because of the fusiform and sacular aneurysm superimposed, but that's day three. Definitely not on presentation at all.
And Dr. Reno, how about your take on the LP? Would you have LP'd? Two questions. Would you have done the LP, and would you have used benzathine penicillin for this case? Because as Dr. Hook says, that's adequate for cardiovascular syphilis.
Yeah. So yes and no. So I think the LP, like Dr. Hook said, is indicated in a patient with cardiovascular syphilis. And I think once that RPR comes back, our suspicion is going to be much more elevated, and we're going to want to make sure how just exactly where that the disease is disseminated. We'd probably be using the high dose IV penicillin for us.
Would you add benzodiazepine at the end, say 2 weeks of?
Yes, I would. I mean, he needs 3 weeks of treatment, falling back on. If it was solely limited to the heart, he still need, and the cardiovascular system, he needs 3 weeks, so he would get a shot at the end.
So he'd get 10 to 14 days. You treat him as neurosyphilis and then add benzodiazepine at the end?
Yes.
Probably.
I'm just going to say yes, probably.
Sure. All right. Any questions from the audience?
Good.
So one of the things I was looking up last night, which was very fascinating to me, and I wanted panelists to comment on that. There was a series that was just in one of the cardiology journals from Baylor, a series of 23 patients that they looked at that had thoracic aortic aneurysms, and they did pathology. And one of the things that was very interesting to me, they had 23 patients over 6 years. Which is phenomenal, because most of us that do a lot of syphilis really say that this is rare. And the question is, it may be more common than we think. The other interesting point about it, there was an editorial that was written, which was fascinating, and I wanted to tell Ned about this. It was very interesting. So it was talking about whether we're treating enough with enough medications, and what they ended up doing with this patient, which was just a little bit out there to my knowledge, was giving IV penicillin in combination with IV ceftriaxone for 10 days and doxycycline. So I was wondering if the panel could comment on that.
Wow. I think Dr. Hook should answer that one first.
One of the things we often remind our colleagues when we do infectious disease consultations at our places, you can only kill a bacterium once. I think that's over-treatment. That's the short answer. I also think they're interesting theoretical concerns. You know, a number of years ago and from time to time, there are discussions about whether treating with bacteriostatic agents then actually impairs your therapy with bactericidal agents simply by suppressing the metabolism of organisms. So that's interesting. The other thing I would really, this is a suggestion to the audience more than anything else. I do think we are more attuned to syphilis for the next few years than we have been for the last 10. I think it's important to pay attention, and I think many of you will probably encounter patients where you're asked the question, do you think this patient has syphilitic aortitis? And if you have tissue, especially pre-therapeutic tissue, we now are in an era when we can do PCR on tissue. And most of the diagnoses to date of cardiovascular syphilis have been based on the demonstration of silver staining fibrils in a blood vessel. Unfortunately, the silver stain also stains elastin and other fibrous tissue as well. And it would be delightful and really helpful to all of us, I think, going forward to start doing some PCR on some of these surgical specimens. So take that opportunity if you get the chance. That would be a request.
All right, we'll have to let that be the last word, I'm afraid. So thank you, Dr. Gao. Thank you, panelists. We'll move on to the next question.